I was worried about the, you know, DCF showing up three times a year and inspecting me on 537 points of inspection.
Republican leadership in the Florida House joining with liberal media and joining with Democrats to launch baseless smears.
We will be able to have screenings and share it in some way, but not on the scale that we would like.
From the fourth floor of the Capitol Rotunda, you're listening to WFSU Public Media's Capitol Report, the podcast. I'm Tom Flanagan.
Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org.
This is Capitol Report, the podcast. I'm Tom Flanagan. Among today's Capitol action, Florida parents know the cost of child care can be prohibitive, if they can even find some. Now, a state lawmaker who has four young children is sponsoring a bill aimed at making child care less costly and more available. Margie Menzel tells us more.
Sarasota Republican Representative Fiona McFarland says child care and daycare and preschool all mean the same thing.
We've decided as a state that we're constitutionally required to provide free education for children in K through 12, but we don't talk about what happens before that baby turns five.
McFarland has four children under the age of five. The youngest is a baby she brings with her to Tallahassee. And she says the cost of paying for child care is stretching her budget.
Our parents said, I can't have another child because I can't afford to send him to college. Well, today we say, I can't afford to have another child because I can't find child care for them. So this bill addresses that.
McFarland's bill would streamline inspections for child care providers who are in good standing. It would help providers hire employees by reducing the amount of time the Department of Children and Families has to spend on background screening. It would require DCF to offer free training and testing online.
And my favorite part is it creates a license-exempt category for child care that's offered by our employers. Last year, you all voted on a bill that created a tax credit for employers that want to build or provide their own child care. And this is part two of that, which is, say, if an employer is going to make their own child care that's just for their workforce, for their employees' children or grandchildren to go, that they can be license-exempt.
The bill would also grant child care facilities a break from certain local taxes, and it works to make it easier for the businesses to get insurance. McFarland says she can't guarantee that child care prices will drop overnight if her bill becomes law, but she says she's talked to many employers about it.
You come and tell me that we have a national worker shortage, you can't find employees. Have you ever thought about offering child care? They said, yeah. We actually looked at it, but the regulatory burden was too high. I was worried about the, DCF showing up three times a year and inspecting me on 537 points of inspection. So I just thought I would stick with making widgets or whatever it is.
Fort Pierce Republican Representative Dana Trabalsi thanked McFarland, saying that every year she moves the needle on early learning a little further. Trabalsi says the tax credit lawmakers created last year for employer-based child care has helped her family directly.
My daughter has two children, and the company that my son-in-law works for has taken advantage of the tax credit. And although the company that he works for couldn't afford to give him a raise this year, what they could do is offer this benefit. So it's like putting $7,200 back in their pocket every year. And that's a big amount when you're raising a family.
McFarland says the measure would help her as well as other Floridians.
This is a bill that I wrote and I filed and I've worked on for myself. I mean, obviously, I hope that it will directly benefit me. But for every me that it benefits is another mom in your district that has, one kid or five kids that are not yet in the K through 12 system. And parents everywhere are really hurting on how expensive child care is. I hope that this helps, even just a little bit.
Lakeland Republican Senator Colleen Burton is carrying the Senate companion. I'm Margie Menzel.
Capitol reporter Tristan Wood joins us here. And there was some excitement over the weekend, as I understand it, Tristan. The whole Florida political world kind of a buzz with some reporting from the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times that talked about Governor Ron DeSantis' administration directing, what, $10 million of taxpayer money through the First Lady, Casey DeSantis' charity, to several political committees. And those committees helping, what, fight the recreational marijuana ballot initiative that narrowly got defeated last year in the election. So we're trying to follow up on all the different reactions and what is, in essence, kind of a complicated story. So maybe you can shed some additional light on what's really going on with this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So Centene is a medical company and was found in court that it overbilled Florida Medicaid by about $67 million. Now, usually when that happens, Tom, the money is budgeted back to the state. But the Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration, which Governor DeSantis controls, instructed the company to give $10 million to Casey's Hope Florida Foundation. From there, the charity gave two $5 million grants to different dark money groups who then, days later, gave $8.5 million to a political action committee controlled by then DeSantis Chief of Staff James Uthmeyer, who is now our Attorney General. Now, that PAC, as you said, was being used to fight the recreational marijuana ballot initiative, and that PAC gave $10.5 million to the Florida GOP to do so. That PAC also sent $1 million to DeSantis' personal campaign political committee, so the money went to fight marijuana and to DeSantis' political operation himself. Now, it's typical for political campaign money to bounce between multiple sources like that in a way that appears to confuse those who are trying to follow it. But using money owed to the state to combat a citizen ballot initiative via this process is very unusual.
Yeah, and also, again, it creates levels of complexity that would seem to be really difficult to kind of unpeel. This is a complicated onion. So Florida politicians here, others, particularly in the midst and the waning weeks of a legislative session, how are they reacting to all this?
Now, there was a lot of chatter on social media over the weekend with several Republican lawmakers who've been beefing with DeSantis for a while, criticizing him for it, while his allies were defending him. Uthmeyer, who was recently appointed Florida's Attorney General by DeSantis, defended the actions during a press conference Monday and seemingly downplayed the money connection.
You've got an independent foundation that's got its own board. It's a not-for-profit, and it made its own decision to give generous support to other not-for-profits that, by the way, already work with the entity and share that same mission, helping moms, helping families, protecting our kids. That's totally fine. There's nothing wrong with that. And if some of those organizations were already active in the fight to oppose a dangerous constitutional amendment that would have allowed recreational marijuana to be used anywhere, there's also not a problem with that.
But Florida Democrats, like House Minority Leader Fentress Driscoll, think something criminal may have occurred.
At best, this was the inappropriate use of settlement dollars. At worst, this was fraud. This looks, smells, and feels like an illegal, coordinated scheme to use our tax dollars to fund political actions by Ron DeSantis. The facts point to a plan to stop constitutional amendments that he didn't like.
All right, now this gets us into some upcoming power politics, Tristan, because Governor DeSantis termed out in 2026. He cannot run for re-election. So his political career, at least as governor, is coming to a close. What are some of the other implications that are coming out of all this right now, since he's kind of out of the mix?
Now, there are two main things, Tom, at play here. First, legislative Republicans are willing to publicly pounce on this in a clear escalation of the rift that has grown between them and the governor. The two groups have been publicly feuding since they had disagreements on how to enact immigration policy back in January. The governor has expressed anger that they are criticizing him and Casey for this.
I'm used to the baseless smears from liberal media. I'm used to the baseless smears from Democrats. I've been dealing with it for over 6 years. It's par for the course. But I think now we have Republican leadership in the Florida House joining with liberal media and joining with Democrats to launch baseless smears against Hope Florida, and by extension, myself, and the First Lady. Let me tell you something. None of these Republican leaders got elected on the platform that they were going to launch baseless attacks against the governor and First Lady. That is not why they got elected. Had they run on that, they would have lost their primaries. They would never have been elected in the first place.
Now, the second impact that this could have particularly is that it's stinging for Casey's political aspirations. There's intense speculation that she will run for governor, but with Congressman Byron Donalds already being endorsed by President Donald Trump, and now this scandal unfolding, it seems more and more like she would be running against headwinds. Florida's recreational marijuana ballot amendment got 56% support. While that didn't pass, that margin of support would make this emerging scandal a likely line of attack against Casey if she decides to run.
Yeah, despite the fact that her husband, Governor DeSantis, gave her a very complimentary shout out in the course of the State of the State address that kicked off this legislative session and applauding her for her Hope Florida initiative and all that. And that raised some eyebrows too. Like, why is he doing that?
And yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they've been appearing with each other at press conferences several times over the last several months. This is when DeSantis has a press conference about something he's doing as governor. He has Casey along and has her say some statements. So he's been, you know, using his public profile to help promote her to likely be the person that he wants to run to replace him. But with this scandal emerging, especially with her name tied to it, now they're both having to be on the defense.
Yeah, watch this space. Things are getting very interesting at the old Florida Capitol. And Capitol reporter Tristan Wood brings us up to date on this. Thanks, Tristan.
Thanks, Tom.
The Department of Government Efficiency pulled grants awarded to the National Endowment for the Humanities and fired 80% of the organization's staff in March. The endowment also funds state humanities councils that support local arts programs, museums, and libraries. WUSF's Lily Belcher spoke with the executive director of Florida Humanities, Nasheed Medjuin, about how the cuts could impact the arts in Florida.
Florida Humanities exists as the storyteller of Florida. And when you capture those stories, you also preserve the heritage and culture of those communities. Some of those stories are in rural and underserved or hard to reach places. There are community heroes that are doing significant things to uplift society. Humanities also helps people in conversation and community dialogue.
And so these DOGE cuts that the National Endowment for the Humanities has faced, how are those going to impact local humanity programs supported by your organization?
We facilitate a lot of grant making, and our grant making is supported with NEH federal dollars. We did have slated for this year two grant rounds, and that's about $250,000 there that we won't be able to award a variety of programs that they've taken the time to gather information and position scholars to ensure authenticity and integrity of the work they do and tell those stories, volunteers, and scheduling activities. That's going to stop, and they would need to rethink how to produce those programs. Some of those programs would not happen. And so those cuts really put a stop to a lot of the advancement in these communities. Last year, we were able to complete a documentary that examined the impact of Hurricane Ian. The documentary also looks at resilience and how the community rebuilds. And so we were seeking to launch that documentary, but also position it so that during the upcoming hurricane season, people can see the impact of the hurricane, but also understand the resources available so they can prepare and move forward. Disseminating that rich history will be reduced. We will be able to have screenings and share it in some way, but not on the scale that we would like.
In the absence of this federal money from the endowment, how will Florida Humanities continue to function and be funded?
We have to look at alternative sources. We have a good history of membership support, foundation support, individual support over the past 50 years. And so we'll scale back some of the activities. We won't reach 67 counties, of course. We will have to focus on those counties we can have access to. There are specialized programs like our Humanities Festival that we just had in Sarasota at the Selby Library. Some 400 to 500 people showed up and were able to understand the rich history of that region. Programs like that will either be scaled back or cut.
What does your organization want to highlight through the work?
We definitely want to highlight the value of humanities and understanding what it is to tell the stories of people, understanding the triumphs and obstacles, and capturing those stories and being the champion of those stories is incredible. And we need to continue that good work and ensure that we are disseminating the culture and the legacy of Florida around the state and beyond.
That was Executive Director of Florida Humanities, Nasheed Madyun, talking with WUSF's Lily Belcher about recent budget cuts. Finally tonight, well, you may have already noticed it the last time you pulled into the pump, the average price of a gallon of gas in Florida dropped 9 cents during the past week. That was amidst an increase in supply and concerns about the effects of tariffs. According to the AAA Auto Club, Florida drivers are now paying an average of $3.09 per gallon for regular unleaded. AAA spokesman Mark Jenkins says increased production and a decrease in demand could keep prices down.
You have some concerns about a potential economic downturn that has also helped to keep oil prices somewhat in check because of concerns that demand might taper off a little bit.
Nationally, the average price today was $3.18 a gallon. The Fort Walton Beach area had the state's lowest average price today, while the most expensive gas in Florida is being sold in the West Palm Beach area. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Lily Belcher. Shows are available Monday through Thursday by 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time, wherever you get your podcasts. On many of these Florida public radio stations, you can tune in each Friday to catch the latest on all things happening at the Capitol. That show is also available in podcast form. Technical assistance comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report, the podcast from WFSU Public Media.
Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org. Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.